The Guardian.
This is Politics Weekly. I'm Jessica Elgott.
If you want to understand why it is that we must leave the EU and the advantages of coming out, I want you to consider this kipper.
On Monday, it's pretty much safe to say that Boris Johnson will be announced as the 77th Prime Minister of the United Kingdom. But after a career littered with lies, casual racism, affairs and fantasy bridges, is Johnson really cut out to be PM? Also this week, we bid farewell to our current PM, Theresa May, in the company of The Guardian sketch writer John Crace. And it's not just the Tories who'll be announcing a new leader next week. We talked to Sir Vince Cable about the Lib Dem leadership and his time as leader. That's all in this week's Politics Weekly. But first, Michael Gove says Boris Johnson will be great as Prime Minister. Amber Rudd has suddenly realised that a no-deal Brexit won't be so bad after all. Yes, Tories of all political stripes are suddenly lining up to serve at the court of King Boris. But though Tory party members are awaiting his promised tax cuts and a do-or-die Brexit with great excitement, can Johnson actually deliver? And with his sometimes shaky relationship to the truth and sudden devotion to the Brexit cause, what do we really know about our next PM and where he might take us? Well, I'm joined to discuss all this by Polly Toynbee and Aditya Chakrabarty from The Guardian and Isabel Hardman from The Spectator. So, Polly, what do we know about Boris Johnson's character? We know quite a lot already, don't we?
We know an extraordinary amount about him. We know more about him, probably, than we've known about anybody stepping into Downing Street for many, many a long year, and everything we know is disreputable and disgraceful. We know he is dishonest. We know he's a serial liar. We know that he has swapped positions and will do endlessly. He has no real firm grounding. I mean, maybe in some ways that's a good thing, because he can swing about with whatever necessity comes his way. But he is not a character who virtually nobody who's worked closely with him, either as a journalist or as a politician, has much respect for.
I mean, what could we say about his record?
Almost everything he's done, he's failed at. He was a Brussels correspondent, very successful, but only by selling absolutely outrageous untruths. But it did quite well because it was entertaining. But he did get fired from the Times for lying. His previous editor, Max Hastings of The Telegraph, has written excoriating things about him and why he didn't fire him for the recording that appeared where he was apparently willing to hand out a journalist's address to have him beaten up by a disreputable friend of his. I would have thought that was a firing offence. Almost anyone who's worked in a significant way with him has come out and said how impossible he is and how disgraceful. So leaving behind as Mayor of London, you know, huge debts, outrageously expensive vanity projects, one after another, ridiculous buses, a ridiculous bridge that was never built, a ridiculous sort of cable car that no one uses.
Water cannons
that had to be sold at a loss. He does things that are fun, that take his fancy. He's a big child. And nobody seems to stop him. But maybe this time the Treasury will say no.
Isabel, is it right? You know, he's often kind of painted as this kind of pseudo-Trumpian character. Is it fair to paint Boris in that light? Apart, you know, he's clearly, you know, pretty right-wing on Brexit. But is that where he is on other things?
I think he does deploy some Trumpian tactics and has picked up more of them over the past couple of years. So some of the ways in which he tries to get attention through his columns, for instance, and the way that he responds to the media a bit as well, actually, the sort of ridiculing of journalists, I think you could say is Trumpian. But actually, if you look at his politics, Polly was saying that he's able to switch positions quite a lot. That is sometimes a good thing, actually. That's a sort of political flexibility as opposed to ideological dogma isn't the worst thing in politics. And it does mean that if you talk to cabinet ministers, some of whom are performing interesting gymnastics themselves in order to stay in his cabinet, they are actually not dreading a Johnson premiership, because he is, if not malleable, at least very open to new ideas and new perspectives. And he is also a tremendous delegator. Now, you might say the flip side of this is that he's just lazy, but he does leave his ministers, or when he was in City Hall, his key appointees, to get on with the job. And that's something that if you're a cabinet minister, you're obviously delighted by in general, but especially after three years of Theresa May, who would make you send the same email three times before she even read it.
Do you think it's, you know, quite often you'll also hear supporters of Boris Johnson, particularly of those who've kind of perhaps come over to support him from the left of the Tory party, that he's in fact, you know, he's a London liberal, he's not a reactionary at all. In fact, he's always, you know, supported things like gay rights or even an amnesty for illegal immigrants when he was London mayor. Do you buy any of that kind of repainting of him?
I've certainly always thought of him as being a social liberal, but you used a phrase, Jess, which made me think. You talked about him being possibly neo-Trumpian, and I think that is a real danger to our politics. You have a president of the United States who's now openly racist, telling elected representatives to go back where they came from. And you have the man who's about to become prime minister, who has used laughingly racist language in the past in his journalism. He's talked about pickaninnies, watermelon smiles. I mean, there's a whole litany of this stuff which he's produced over time. And he's always passed it off as just a joke. You also have a country which is unmooring itself from the EU, as we know, with some difficulty. And so we are looking to strike trade deals, the most important of which will be with America. And so our relationship with America becomes very important. We know that Boris Johnson has met Steve Bannon, who was the brain, as much as one can have one, for Trump. We know that Boris Johnson is very, very wary of criticising Donald Trump. We also have a country which is heading towards some kind of recession at some point towards the end of this year, beginning of next. Put all of that together, what do you have? You have an economy that turns nasty and has people looking around for people to blame for why they are poorer after a decade in which they've actually got no richer. You have a president who will, as he goes into his own election in America, will be ramping up that rhetoric because it holds his base together and creates a clear divide with the Democrats. And then you have a prime minister over here who's actually no foreigner to any of those terms, those racist terms, and will not, as far as we know, will not do what Sadiq Khan and others have done in British politics, will not condemn a man who's racist. I'm pretty frightened by all of that when you put it all together, because you have the spectre of a racist transatlantic alliance which is intent upon a kind of ethno-nationalism which we haven't seen in world politics for 70 years or so.
Paul, is that in a way, I mean, no deal plays into that, but is that in a way a sort of more frightening, bigger picture than even what Brexit could hold?
Yes, I think that's exactly right, and I think it is very frightening, and it is sort of global in its reach. What an American president says has huge echoes all around the world. If an American president gives permission for outrageous racism, it fires up that ingredient in countries all over the place. If American president's doing it, that must be the way things are done. You know, America's always been influential for good and bad, and this time very much for bad, so I think it's very frightening. The idea that, which Isabel said, which I think is true, that of how malleable and flexible Boris is, but only towards wherever his interests lie, and he is plainly, firmly in the pocket and owes everything to the far right of his own party, the hardest of Brexiters. Fear of Farage is what's got him there, so he's got to be as Farage-like as possible. And that's what's so frightening. I don't see an equivalent pressure to push him towards the left of his party. They feel quite weak.
Do you think that's right, Isabel? Do you think that there's... And it may be, of course, the case that before the October 31st, Boris has to let down that faction of the party if he can't quite deliver a Brexit on that date for whatever reason.
Yeah, he's got a really tall task ahead of him. And I think people who are saying that he can just pass Theresa May's deal with better salesmanship are probably misreading quite how purious the European Research Group actually is. I mean, this is the group who... actually wouldn't see most of the Tory leadership candidates at the start of the contest because they just weren't Brexity enough for them to even bother listening to them. It was only Boris Johnson and Dominic Raab who were granted a hearing with the senior members of the ERG. And so if people think that really the ERG are suddenly going to be blinded by, I don't know, Boris's hair while he sells
Theresa May's... Them
and, yeah, exactly. Yeah. I'm not sure that's really how those Brexiteers work. This is their life's mission, and whether or not they like Boris Johnson, they will quite happily turn on him if they feel that he's going to betray that, which is why he has really upped his rhetoric on no deal in the past few days. We saw in the Sun hustings on Monday him declaring the backstop to be dead and dismissing a time limit or a unilateral exit clause, and those two things are really the only sort of negotiable options. And so we see no deal looming far closer now, which is something that he needs to do in terms of the wing of the party that will probably likely actually cause him the most trouble, even if you have, you know, as we've got at the moment, threats of resignations from the sort of Philip Hammond wing of the party.
Do you think they'd actually remove him? Do you think the ERG would actually move against their man? And if so, in favour of who?
The Tories like to make threats about moving against people, you know, the whole time. I can't think of a month of covering the Tory party where there hasn't been a threat against any leader, you know, sort of mutterings about David Cameron, even when he was doing reasonably well in a sort of Cameronish way. And so I think you would get complaints against Boris Johnson. Don't forget that there are lots of Brexiteers who have a bit of a distaste for him anyway, and so will find it quite easy to get irritated by him, even if you don't have a move against him.
But they've got no other champion. I mean, if it's not Boris, they've got nobody else who can win
for them.
There are
harder Brexiteers in the Tory party than Boris Johnson, and it seems hard to believe that.
Who think they can lead as well. Who, you know, so people like Steve Baker, who gave a few sort of hints that he might go for the leadership before jumping out of a plane.
But he could never win an election. It's conceivable Boris could win an election. He does have charm. He does have what's called charisma.
He's a celebrity.
Yeah. He's a celebrity. He makes people laugh. Everybody wants to selfie with him. People want to be in his group. They want to sit and have a drink with him. He has all of that clubbability that makes somebody quite electable. I don't think Steve Baker or any of them have it.
If we look at the recent polling of Tory members, and I would say this probably extends to some Tory MPs, they seem to be willing to risk almost anything to deliver a fairly destructive Brexit. You know, whether it's Scotland leaving the Union, whether it's Northern Ireland leaving the Union, and they even say they would be prepared to risk the destruction of their own party.
Would they be willing to lose an election, though?
Well, the one thing that they say that they're not willing is to countenance Jeremy Corbyn as Prime Minister, which is an interesting thing about whether they think that the other three options are actually, whether they actually could happen, that they see Corbyn as something that could happen, whereas the others feel kind of slightly more detached. There are people who seem to be willing to risk the fact that it could tear their party in two if it means delivering Brexit by any kind of means necessary. And I mean, I wonder if you think, Aditya, that Boris has kind of painted himself into a corner by ramping up this kind of rhetoric and now making narrower and narrower promises on things like the backstop, for example, that he won't even accept a time limit on that, which means that he can't. He's just got such a narrow window of something that he can deliver.
I think, Jess, that has something to do with what Isabel referred to as malleability, that he will make promises as he goes. Sometimes he'll improvise a promise without really thinking about it. I mean, that's been a feature of his career, both in journalism and in politics. You also have to put him against what you just said about the Conservative base. And the Conservative Party, within the course of this decade, has moved very sharply to the right. So all the pressure is on him to just veer right, and that, I think, leads him to make ever more extravagant political claims, which actually could meet a really hard reality in the face of Barnier and the rest of the EU. That, I think, is his only real kind of brick wall, is actually what Brussels says in return. The unfortunate thing about that, from a kind of domestic politics view, is what does that then translate to? It translates to Prime Minister Boris Johnson turning to the country and saying, I know you all voted for Brexit and here I am trying to do it, and those people won't do it, so we're just going to have to leave without a deal.
And it's the EU that can be painted then as being the unreasonable.
Of course, and that has distinct origin in his own journalism, right?
Oh, yes.
How did he make his name?
Johnny Foreigner. Johnny Foreigner is doing this to filthy Brussels, is doing it to us. We've just heard yet again even more intransigence from Brussels saying there's no way you're going to remove the backstop. You know, it's never been a possibility. And so then he faces no deal Brexit. Now, it's all very well blaming it on other people, but the moment there are shortages, even slight shortages, on the shelves of supermarkets, let alone medicines for some people, just a few cases of hardship, let alone queues for petrol or whatever, we know this country doesn't have much Blitz spirit, really, when it comes to it. I mean, there was even a terrible drama about Kentucky Fried Chicken running out of chicken. So I don't think we're going to be kind of up for no deal, in which case he'll be in real trouble. It'll all be his fault.
But Polly, you heard the promises he made just this week. We will definitely have water and Mars bars.
That is a low bar. So,
it's like basically we'll have everything that Cormac McCarthy bequeathed his characters in The Road and nothing more. And that will somehow win him an election. I mean, it is remarkable. It's remarkable how low the bar now is for the no dealers.
But it is interesting when you go to public meetings that MPs have been holding on Brexit over the past few months, the anger of voters, obviously, you know, it's a self-selecting group of people who are going to turn up to a public meeting on a Friday night with the MP, no offence to the MPs whose meetings I've sat in on, but that they're so angry and they're so sort of desperate for Brexit that they do buy into this Blitz spirit thing that Polly mentions, to the extent that I was at one public meeting where someone shouted, you know, we can feed ourselves, we did during the war. And I was sort of thinking, well, what about all those deaths in the Merchant Navy? I'm not sure we were feeding ourselves, actually.
It's a during madness.
The war. But there is this kind of determination to see Brexit through, to the extent that you actually don't really think about the consequences. And if anyone points out the consequences, as some of these MPs have been doing, of a no-deal Brexit, people get very angry.
But what will those angry people do you think, when they're actually confronted with real hardship? It's actually there. It's not a fear. Yeah. It's right on their doorstep. Yeah. And angry people possibly in the streets against the likes of them.
I mean, this is the real problem. This is the kind of the rhetoric of the Dunkirk spirit without any of the policies of import substitution. Because what you'd really need, if you want to do that, you can do it. You can just create your own autarkic economy. And other countries have done that. India did that after independence. Problem is, you've got a libertarian economics which sits alongside this kind of promise of
global trade.
Exactly. And you can't, therefore, the two can't meet.
Do you think there are people, and I certainly met them myself going out with MPs, and I met a man in Kent who said that he was perfectly prepared to go back on rations if in a no-deal Brexit. But if you... But
go
is
university
Boris Johnson
credit.
Among them? I mean, it strikes me that he's sort of been saying to the other wing of his party when he was trying to get moderates on board, the chances of the deal are absolutely minuscule, don't worry, you know, we won't have to go through
a
with it. And whether he's
to
prepared
one.
To go through with it, do you think?
I think he is, and I think the people around him are do have that sort of, perhaps not the I'm happy to live on rations perspective, given the fuss that MPs make about any changes to their own conditions. But I think there is a kind of upbeat attitude towards a no-deal Brexit. I mean, you saw from Jacob Rees-Mogg this week saying that the economic benefit of no-deal Brexit could be in the region of, what was it, £80 billion?
£80 billion. This comes from Patrick Minford. And, of course, to some extent, it's true. If you were willing to demolish all homegrown industry, if you were willing to have no manufacturing and no farming and no fishing pretty much too, and to simply import the cheapest stuff from all over the world, you could bring food prices down a lot. But on the other hand, you'd have so many people unemployed, not many people could probably even afford food at those prices.
But what I think that will benefit Boris Johnson is that there are so many people to blame in this whole Brexit mess that it's very easy to deflect it, even if you are responsible. So you can blame Theresa May, obviously, for getting us to this point where we have no choice but to leave on a no deal. You could blame Chris Grayling for having any sort of contact with the transport system, which he obviously has as transport secretary, and that's quite important if you're trying to get deliveries to factories and through our ports and so on. You can blame the Brexiteers, you can blame the Remainers,
business,
and you can blame business, you know, you can blame Jeremy Corbyn. There are so many people who everyone else can turn on that it's very easy actually for that anger to be deflected away from the Prime Minister at the time.
I'll tell you why, because I think every time a Prime Minister fails to govern a country, it's curtains for them, really.
Mm. Although it'll be the first time that Boris Johnson has experienced that, because he's so far managed to make all his mistakes someone else's fault. And so I suppose it will come as a shock to him and to everyone else, because I think he's expecting, as he has throughout his career, for someone else to take the blame.
Could be a bumpy ride. Good luck, everyone.
It's time to focus.
I think ultimately that ideology is fading, but it will have a sting in the tail, and we see that sometimes with these flare-ups and violence.
Today in Focus is the new daily podcast from The Guardian. Join me, Anoushka Astana, for the best stories from our journalists around the world. Subscribe now to Today in Focus from The Guardian.
Welcome back. Theresa May has been busy these last few weeks. She's announced a domestic abuse bill, an office for tackling injustices, a police covenant guaranteeing support for police officers, and increased education spending. Some have observed that it's almost as though May is trying to secure some sort of legacy for herself, other than the one leaving the country even more divided over Brexit than before. So as May prepares to hand back the keys to Number 10, how will her tenure as Prime Minister be remembered? I caught up with John Crace earlier, The Guardian's parliamentary sketchwriter and author of I, Maybot.
I think there was a bit of lazy sexist stereotyping about her to start with, that, you know, we'd had one female prime minister and there was an automatic assumption that the second woman prime minister had to be a clone, if you like. And if you remember, at her very first PMQs, Theresa May did put on a Margaret Thatcher voice. So it was almost as though she thought she had to fit into that sort of stereotype as well. And, you know, also for the first 3 or 4 months, she was given a very easy ride by a lot of the media who were, you know, she was saying things like Brexit means Brexit, and everybody thought that was sort of really tough. And it took me a while to actually think, hang on a moment, there is less to her than meets the eye. And, you know, and that's when, I think it was November 2016, she became Prime Minister in July. And it was November 2016 that I started calling her the Maybot. And, you know, it sort of gradually took hold. But it was during the general election of 2017 that it sort of snowballed, and loads of other newspapers started calling her the Maybot as well. You know, The Spectator did a front cover of her as a Maybot. And I think, you know, the moment, the sort of defining moment was The Sun, in the week before the general election, did an interview with her when they said, what does it feel like to be characterised as a Maybot? And she said, I don't recognise that description. And I kind of thought, my job is done.
Yeah, she basically played into it completely.
Yeah.
You never interacted with her personally about this description.
No, and I don't think I'm alone in that. I think I don't think many in the cabinet would say they've had sort of close interactions with her. No, I've never had any sort of first-hand experience with her. I mean, you know, to her credit, I've never had any kind of complaints, and she's always sent me a Christmas card, which is more than Jeremy Corbyn's ever sent me, I will have to say. So I do feel a sort of surge of gratitude for that. And, you know, I think, you know, given what's likely to come in the shape of sort of Boris Johnson, there may be, you know, a sort of slight tinge of sadness at her regret that what we thought was sort of sheer incompetence was only the beginning of a nightmare.
What do you think of her legacy?
I don't think history will be unduly kind to her, though, you know, one should never say never, because it's just possible that sort of after a year of Boris Johnson, we might be all begging her to come back.
John Crace there. So Polly, will you shed a tear when Theresa May leaves number 10?
Well, the awful thing is that Boris Johnson may be so terrible that we really will. And she will only be the second worst prime minister we've ever had. But that's pretty depressing.
Isabel, she's announced a sort of raft of these new initiatives over the past week. Has she got a legacy? Is it too little too late for that? Or will she always be the prime minister that just failed on the one thing she was supposed to achieve?
I think largely she will be the prime minister who failed to deliver Brexit. I think there is one bit of her legacy that we probably should applaud her for, which is her commitment to domestic abuse legislation. The only problem is that she procrastinated on that as well as everything else. And so she's had to rush it out at the very last minute, hoping that her successor won't either forget about it or do things to weaken it in a sort of committee stage when no one really notices the amendments that governments make. That bill also needs a lot more funding to go alongside it, as well as the legislative measures. So it's still really quite an empty legacy, and it requires her successor to pick something up for her to be able to point to anything that's really got any sort of longevity.
What do you think? Is there anything that we can say about Theresa May's legacy that's beyond, you know, the failing to do something?
I want to go against my colleagues and enter a plea of mitigation for Theresa May. I think if you look at her position, there is something really quite tragic about looking at a obviously public-spirited woman prime minister surrounded by useless men who keep saying to her, you must clear up this mess over Brexit, even while doing their best to thwart her. I think there is something also quite tragic about seeing a prime minister who, after the EU referendum, could talk within conservative terms about what had gone wrong in the country that led it to vote for this act of gigantic self-harm, could identify burning injustices, could talk very well about what happened to black boys when they went into the criminal justice system, and all the rest of it, could even identify what was wrong within Britain's particularly bust model of capitalism, and then could not do anything about it. She was in many ways a really promising critic of the post-Thatcherite settlement in this country. Her great tragedy was that she had to deal with Brexit. She was completely frustrated by her own party, and she then could not follow up the rather promising domestic policy agenda. Not one that I would necessarily subscribe to every, you know, INT, but one that I think makes sense within Conservative terms and could probably rescue the Conservative Party from the cul-de-sac it's now gone down.
Thanks very much, all. Now, it's easy to forget that there's another leadership battle going on right now. Jo Swinson and Ed Davey have been politely jostling to become the next leader of the Liberal Democrats. Having seen off the threat of Change UK, the Lib Dems now seem to be pretty much the only option left for disaffected soft Tories and Remainer Labour voters. The coalition with the Tories seemed to have finished them off. In 2015, they plummeted from 57 seats to just 8. But at the recent EU elections, they gained nearly 20% of the vote, coming second only to the Brexit Party. So can the Lib Dems find themselves a significant political force once more? Well, earlier I spoke to the departing leader of the Lib Dems, Sir Vince Cable.
So, last few days in the job, and do you have much time for contemplation, or is it...?
Not really, not at this stage. No, I doubt that will over the summer, but I'm, you know, just looking forward to a break and rounding off my term here, but... No, I'm sure I will over the summer sort of reflect a little bit more on everything.
I mean, you sort of stayed pretty neutral in this leadership contest, but what is the thing you'd like to sort of pass on, you know, if there's one pearl of wisdom that you feel you've learnt during your time as leader about leading the party rather than just being a key figure in it, what would you say that should be?
Well, I think several things. I mean, I think, first of all, you do need patience, and you need a fairly thick skin, because... I mean, for about 18 months of my 2 years, there was a sort of pent-up frustration that we were doing all the right things and saying all the right things, and it wasn't cutting through. And then we realised that a lot of the groundwork that we had been laying was productive, and it did bear fruit in the local elections, and that, you know, the key messages we had on Brexit actually worked. So, but you know, being patient during that period of time was a struggle, you know.
Personally, as well as for people around.
Yes. I think people were, you know, getting agitated. You know, why is it that we're still stuck at 7% or 8% for the last 8 years or 9 years? Why is this a sort of given by nature or something, and that we're never ever going to get past it? And it was an issue, of course, within the party, but even more with people who weren't really familiar with what we were doing. I mean, sort of party donors and people like that, you know, why is it that, you know, and that it was that kind of sentiment that gave rise to the Change Party, you know,
yeah, sort of sure.
setting up in competition, and that was quite a difficult moment, but I think we handled that correctly, and they imploded. So I think we finished up in a good place, and not just by, a few recent good moves and good luck, but I think it's been a steady process of accumulation. It started really before me, but, you know, Tim Farron was the leader. We were starting to win local by-elections, get some good results locally. And I spent a lot of my time, not here, but, you know, going around the country, making local parties, encouraging them to, put up more candidates, get back into local councils, rebuild the infrastructure. And spent quite a bit of time, you know, just talking to people who were willing to help us fund things like an improved social media operation, which actually, by the time we got to the Euro election, was outstandingly good. So it was that kind of rather behind the scenes type of preparatory work that I think that's a fair summary, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And do you think that the Lib Dems obviously sort of seem to be on the up, and do you think that that's something that can only continue to happen while Labour, or at least there's perception in the public that Labour are prevaricating on the Brexit issue?
Yeah.
If Jeremy Corbyn suddenly comes out and addresses a people's vote rally and says we're a Remain party now, does that damage the...
Well, A, it's not going to. And B, I think it's probably too late to restore their position. I mean, we've had so many false dawns where, you know, one day we get a lot of press build-up, Labour's finally going to commit itself to, you know, Remain, a referendum. And then when the small print comes out a couple of days later, you find that that's what really wasn't what they were doing. I mean, it's just not going to happen. And I think part of our strong revival, and it's the fact that the Tories and the Labour Party have simultaneously gone off in extreme directions. And more than just Brexit. I think even if Brexit stopped, people would be asking themselves, why on earth do we have this kind of English nationalism on one hand and sub-Marxist Leninism on the other? I mean, it just makes no sense in our kind of country.
Do you fear a Boris Johnson government? Do you think that the kind of, some sort of right-wing commentators call it like a Boris derangement syndrome, that people are sort of over-egging the threat that a Boris Johnson premiership could pose? Say he's not neo-Trumpian, he's more liberal than that. What do you buy?
Well, I just don't know. I don't know him well enough. And, you know, having seen him for a distance, I mean, I think there are kind of three different views about him, actually, any of which could prove to be dominant. I mean, one is what he's saying, which is alarming and, as you say, Trumpian, and just populist and demagogic and divisive and nasty and a lot of other things. A second view would be like, as he was with the Mayor of London, tries to be, you know, a non-political consensus type individual. That's not the role he's playing at the moment, but it's conceivable, you know, he could lapse into that. And then the other one is that he's, you know, which he has also demonstrated, he's been completely and utterly opportunistic and switching sides and doing U-turns all over the place. I think one of the reasons that George Osborne endorsed him as Tory leader was that he thought he was the most likely candidate to embrace a referendum. having said he wouldn't do it. Which of these three personalities, I have no idea, I don't know him well enough, but I think there was that program yesterday, which is about him. Mm. I think the one thing that came out very clearly is this is somebody who is play acting the whole time, playing roles. I mean, it's quite unlike Trump, who obviously is himself, however much we despise it. But he's playing a role, and as I said, there are at least three different roles we've seen him play, and we don't know when he gets on the stage which he will decide he wants to be.
Vince Cable there. Isabel, do you think it's a short-term bounce for the Lib Dems? Can they carry on in the trajectory that they're on?
Well, they have benefited from Labour sort of seesawing around on Brexit because they've got such a strong anti-Brexit Remain position, and Labour is trying to harden up its stance, although not with a great deal of success, I have to say. Perhaps by autumn conference it might have a stronger message. So the Lib Dems do need to be careful that they're not complacent about their recent success, but they have performed the bounce back that they told us they were all going to, and we wrote them off really, particularly when a group of Labour MPs left to set up their own party. We said this showed the failure of the Lib Dems to provide a centrist voice, and well, obviously that new project from those Labour MPs, ex-Labour MPs, was a failure, and the Lib Dems have done extremely well since. So they're sort of bright-eyed and bushy-tailed at the moment for the first time in quite a long while, actually.
We're hearing probably quite a few quite outlandish things from both the leadership candidates, from Jo Swinson and Ed Davey, but, you know, both of whom I think have said various points over this leadership concert that they could be PM or they could lead a unity government. I mean, what is this madness, or is this just, you know, electoral talk, or is there something in it?
It's a lot less mad than some of the things that Lib Dems have claimed in the past. Anything is possible at the moment. It is conceivable that we reach an impasse in the Commons where temporarily you need a sort of interim leader of a rebel group from all sorts of people, and maybe the Lib Dems could provide that. It's possible. Or maybe it would be some rebel backbencher from the Tories or Labour. It, you know, things are falling apart, or they might be falling apart, might not get back together again. And that's always the great hope for the third party. And so, yeah, it could be happy days for them.
Do you think it's possibly more likely on, you know, with our feet on the ground, that the Dems could end up as kingmakers again in any sort of snap election, that you end up with Liberal Democrat increase, you know, Labour not quite making a majority, and what do you think the party ends up doing then? Are they going to be damaged again by going into coalition? Do you think they'd be cautious of that? And do you think they'd be cautious of putting Corbyn into number 10? How do you think they could play that?
Oh, my riposte to Polly is, if she says things are falling apart, then I would seem to reply, things fall apart, the centrists cannot hold. Because because I think we give too much credit to Lib Dems in their recent renaissance, right? They're not winning anything positively. They've not got a huge appeal. It's just the other two main parties have got no appeal whatsoever, right? So they are scooping up the refuseniks from within our voting system. And I can't see that stopping for a while, as long as we have Brexit in particular to deal with. I do know that the Labour Party at quite high levels are worried about the threat posed by Lib Dems, purely as a receptacle for those Labour voters who now can't stomach to vote for a party which still talks, you know, which basically straddles both positions on Brexit. That doesn't mean that come a general election, people will forget exactly what role the Lib Dems played in the coalition of 2010 to 2015, which actually led us to the Brexit referendum, right? So people aren't going to forget the promises made by Nick Clegg that he then reneged on, such as on student loans and student tuition fees. And I can't really see either Jo Swinson or Ed Davey with either the recognition or the personal punch through to change that. I would just say about Vince Cable, who you talked to, I think Vince Cable was a very serious critic of and a really intelligent critic of what had gone wrong within British capitalism. And while he was business secretary, came up with a series of very good ideas about how to reform shareholder capitalism. And in a way, I kind of could do with losing the Lib Dems and just keeping Vince Cable around in some capacity.
But it's not really about centrism. I don't think that, you know, there isn't a great centrist project. But Brexit is everything at the moment. And for as long as it is dominant, they rule the roost. They are the Remain group. And people who gathered around them, as why I said interim, would be entirely about Brexit. I don't think they've got anything much to say on anything else.
That is right, Polly. And if you look at the private polling that Labour front benches circulate amongst themselves, it shows that in the big urban centres that, you know, have recently actually held up pretty well under Corbyn, they're really worried about places like London, Bristol, Cambridge, you know, all going over to the Lib Dems or losing significant votes to Lib Dems. And that appears to be happening every time you get a clear run at it.
Which is why we need a progressive alliance to make sure that those forces cohere together on this issue.
And to some extent, also within the Labour front bench, there is a discussion about to what extent you could have a progressive alliance of Labour, the SNP, the Greens, possibly Plaid. I never hear the Lib Dems mentioned as part of that mix, it has to be said. But the electoral mass would lead you towards some kind of progressive alliance. I just don't see the Lib Dems as being part of it. I think they're, I mean, you know this from experience, right? There is a personal animosity towards people who seem to have left Labour in any way or dissented from the line, and they do not get forgiven very easily.
Well, it might be forgive or die.
OK, thanks all. Well, that's all we have time for this week. My thanks to all our guests, Isabel Hardman, Polly Toynbee, Aditya Chakraborty and John Crace. The producer was Simon Barnard. I'm Jessica Elgott. Thanks for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.